Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Nice to see everyone. Lovely morning out there. Lots of snow. I looked out in Lake Calhoun and I could see it looked like in the very middle of the lake someone has made this sort of cone of snow out there. It looks like a snow stupa or something. And if you look out the walk down here, it's straight down that way, straight down from Zen Center. So I kind of wonder what that's all about. So, another Sunday at Zen Center. Is this on? Yes. Another Sunday at Zen Center. Another Sunday on Lake Calhoun. Another Sunday of the same old thing. But not really. Another Sunday that's completely different. If you're new today, if this is the first time you've ever been here to Zen Center, it's probably very easy for you to see how this Sunday is different from all others. How many people are here for the first time, by the way? A lot of people. That's great. That's wonderful. But if you've been here a lot, if you've been coming here for a long time, maybe years and years, it might not be so easy to see how this Sunday is different from all others. It might not be so easy to see the freshness in it. And I just wonder if this has ever happened to you, that maybe you've come here to Zen Center for a sitting, and it kind of seems like the same thing you've always done, and you sit down on your cushion, and you've got the same stuff going through your brain that you've had so many other times, and that same old ego that you've been dragging around for years and years, it's still there, and you just kind of sit there, and you cycle through all this stuff, and it's no big deal, and it's the same old thing. And then you get up, and you put on your coat, and you put on your shoes, and you go out, and you walk down the sidewalk. And maybe you notice some little thing. Maybe a little piece of bark has escaped from the flower beds or something and gotten into the onto the sidewalk. And you look at that little piece of bark, and there's something kind of vivid about it. And then you look up, and you look out this way, and you go, oh, my God, it's Lake Calhoun. And it just hits you. And you don't even really say it's Lake Calhoun because you haven't given it a name yet. It's just this thing that hits you. It's just this totality. It's just life in all of its vividness that just really grabs you. And you realize that something has happened. At some point, you kind of return to yourself because you've been taken completely out of yourself in that moment, right? At some point, you kind of return to yourself and you realize that something has changed since you walked into the Zendo. Maybe you didn't realize anything was happening while you were sitting on your cushion, but now you're suddenly seeing things anew, as they are, without judgment, without opinion, without wanting anything from the situation. You're just seeing this kind of magic, this kind of vividness. And I think we've all experienced something like this. And it might be more noticeable if we're experienced meditators, but it's not limited to experienced meditators. We all have these moments when we just are kind of taken out of ourselves and we experience life in a very direct way. But we don't always see these things. And the nature of the moment is that there's really no one there to perceive. So it's only afterwards that we realize, wow, something happened there. So my subject today is interdependence, and the reason I've been talking about this kind of experience that we sometimes have is that what I'm calling seeing the world anew, I think, is also seeing the interdependent nature of things. So I live in St. Paul now, but a couple of years ago I lived outside of Northfield, which is a small town about an hour south of here, out in the country a bit. And I would go for lots of walks. I had a dog named Beethoven, and I would take Beethoven for walks. And it was a lovely wooded area. There were lots of oaks and aspens and some cottonwoods and some maples and other trees. And I would go for walks. And one thing I like to look at that I've always kind of enjoyed is looking at plant communities, looking at where one plant community begins and where it ends and where these communities meet or blend together and how they change over time. And that's something I've been more open to since I've been meditating. It seems if I go for a walk when I'm in a very open state, I see this thing, and I really enjoy seeing this thing. And this all started once when I was walking my dog, another dog, beside a railroad track. And this dog, he was running loose, and he came to this patch of grass, which was a different kind of grass from the other grass around it. It was kind of taller and kind of wavy. I don't remember just exactly what it was. But I remember my dog going to this patch of grass and just kind of undulating through it. And you could tell he was sort of purposefully doing this thing because he enjoyed it. And he had this look of great satisfaction on his face. And it was such a human-like moment that I was just startled by it. I thought it was just beautiful. And so I saw that. I saw that my dog's reaction, but I also saw this community of grass as a very sort of living thing, as a living thing beyond the individual grass stalks, but just this living community. And I thought I had just seen a new kind of magic, something really subtle and beautiful. So if you live in one place for a number of years and you're kind of attuned to this kind of thing, you can watch how plant communities change over time, and it's pretty cool. There might be an open patch of prairie next to the woods, and sumacs will move into that open piece of prairie, and then maybe some aspen trees will move into the center of the sumacs, and that's how the forest kind of advances into the prairie. There's one particular stand of cottonwoods that I often notice down by Northfield. And I've talked about cottonwoods before. I love cottonwoods because of the sound they make, the rustling of the leaves. They're just very pleasant to be under. And I talked a while back about an experience I had when I was a child lying in a pile of flax straw and setting my book aside and just sort of giving myself over to this sound of being of the cottonwood trees and this feeling of being there. Something that was kind of very different for me, that really kind of took me out of myself, even though I was a small child at the time. But what I noticed about this particular stand of cottonwoods down by Northfield is how they fit together as a group. This was a stand of trees, kind of in the prairie. It was kind of halfway between the woods and the Cannon River in an open spot. So the cottonwoods are kind of out there alone. And it was kind of an elongated grove of maybe 10 or 12 trees. And they all fit together in that the middle ones were very tall and straight, and the ones on the edges were kind of leaning out. So the tree, the grove as a whole, had a very pleasing shape. It kind of looked like one large tree growing. But it was a number of trees together. So if one tree grows on the prairie, it's going to grow evenly in all directions. But if a tree grows next to another tree, it's going to adjust, and it's going to move away from that tree. That's phototropism. That's looking for the light. If it's in the middle of a group of trees, it's probably going to grow very tall and straight in order to reach the light. If it's on the edge of the grove, it's going to lean out in order to get the light. So one thing I like about that grove, aside from the fact that the trees form such a beautiful pattern, is that it's so apparent that each tree is defined by its relationship to the other trees. The grove as a whole resembles one giant tree, and so the grove has its own shape and definition and seems to be an entity in itself. And looking at this, you might wonder, which is more real, the grove or the tree? Which is the living thing? Which entity do we carve out with our mind and choose to see? Is one more real and more definable than the other? More separate from the rest of the universe than the other? A herd of deer is the same way. Another time I was out walking in the same area with my dog in the wintertime. And we came to a place where I saw the largest herd of deer I have ever seen. There must have been 50 or 60 deer altogether. It was really an astonishing sight. And they were foraging in a cornfield at the bottom of a hill. And we came upon them, and they immediately startled, and they started running. They started running up the hill. And they just burst into motion, and they would form little subgroups and unform those groups. And they just went swirling up the hill. It was an entity all in itself. So the movement of each deer was reacting to and dependent upon the movements of the other deer. And I would ask, which was more real, the herd or the individual deer? And I can tell you that at that moment, when I was really astonished by this and really, really taken by it, it was the herd that seemed more real to me. The herd seemed to have a life of its own. The herd seemed to be the living entity. But of course, we know, if we've studied Buddhism a bit, that neither the individual nor the group is more real. Both deer and herd, both tree and grove, are somewhat arbitrary distinctions that we make in an effort to understand the world. And in fact, these things have no intrinsic, separate existence. The separateness is imposed by our mind only. Usually, we choose to see the individual tree. Sometimes, when our mind is very quiet, we may see the grove. Sometimes, we may see beyond the grove. Perhaps, in a very quiet moment, we see the entire river valley. We see it as this living, breathing, interconnected system. So we know that these things, the tree, the grove, the Cannon River Valley, the Mississippi River Valley, North American continent, lack an intrinsic, separate character, are defining them as a kind of mapping. But the other side of this is that, although these things do not have a separate character, they do nonetheless have a character. They do, in a sense, exist, but their character is defined by their interdependence. The tree exists, but it is defined by the grove. It's also defined by the soil and the water it draws up through its roots, and the little creatures that live in it and on it and around it, and the person with his dog who is standing perceiving all this. The tree cannot and does not live or exist, I should say, without these things. If we see the tree without seeing these other things, we're not really seeing the tree. When we say tree, when we're defining this thing that is a tree, we could just as well include the squirrels and the birds and the soil in between the roots. But we generally don't. Generally, when we talk about tree, we're just talking about wood and leaves, and that's all. But what we choose to demarcate and name is just that. It's our choice. It's our perception. It's not reality. We define things by looking at them in isolation. I am me, and you are you. This is a tree, and this is a field, and this is a highway. It's a useful thing to do, of course. It's like making a road map. It's the fact that the map leaves out details that makes it useful. But you wouldn't want to confuse the map with reality. You wouldn't want to pretend that things don't exist just because they're not on the map. So we have this useful perception that we are individuals separate from each other, but we also need to see the reality that we're defined by one another. We have to see both. If we ignore other people because they're not on the map we've created for ourselves, we will make mistakes and get into all kinds of trouble. Another example, if you're a farmer, you divide your land into fields, and this is very useful for purposes of planting, harvesting, cultivating, things like that. But if you do this too narrowly, if you think of your field as separate, the individual field as separate from the other fields for all purposes, you will get into trouble because you need to look at larger issues that will affect more than one field. You need to look at drainage and pest control and irrigation and things like that. You know that dividing your land into fields is helpful, But you would be foolish not to realize that there's a limit to that too, that there are limitations in the usefulness of that. Sometimes you need to see the field. Sometimes you need to see the entire farm. Sometimes the entire river valley. When it comes to political and economic and social forces, you need to see beyond your farm. If you refuse to take an interest in those things and you kind of make your stand on your farm, like John Wayne or something, you will get in trouble because you're refusing to deal with the whole of reality. So there are lots of ways that sticking to the map rather than seeing it as just a map can get you into trouble. We do this all the time. We're incorrigible. We even make maps for our meditation. We make maps about how to give up mapping. But there's hope. There's hope for seeing how everything is interrelated and living accordingly. So I'd like to tell you about something I did when I was in my 20s. One of the things I did to make a living when I was in my 20s, a long time ago, was construction work. I worked on building grain elevators in little towns, mostly in Iowa, a couple in Illinois, one in Minnesota, and I think one in Colorado. These were the big cement grain elevators, the kind you see in little towns that really dominate the landscape, stand many times taller than anything else. Some people call them silos, but they're not to be confused with the silos on farms, which are smaller. I traveled around, and I would do this work, and I would stay in one town for as long as maybe just a week, maybe longer, maybe 4 or 5 months, and I did something like 25 or 30 of these grain elevators, and it was pretty interesting. It was called slip form construction. Did anyone here ever do that? No? Occasionally I run into someone who has, but... slip form construction. It's a way of continuously pouring cement so that you can put up the shell of a grain elevator in just 5 to 7 days. You pour cement around the clock and the thing just kind of grows. And people would have been there, of course, for months doing the preliminary work, building the forms and everything like that. But when the time comes to build it, it just goes up really fast. So you might go to a small town where there was no grain elevator at all, and you put this thing up, and in just a few days, you completely alter the landscape of the town. And it was pretty cool because people would get excited about it. People would come out and watch. They would set up lawn chairs and things like that. It was exciting for them. And they needed a lot of labor for a short time to get this kind of thing done. So there was this community of people that would follow these around, that would follow the slips around. And I was part of that. And it was a fluid community. People would go from one town to another, and they might have a vehicle they lived in or something, you know, a van or a bus, or they might have a little camper or something like that, or they might live in tents, or they might sleep outside. But these people would come together and they would camp, sometimes all in one place for about a week or so, while the slip was going on. And then the job would be over and people would go off. They would go to the next slip, or maybe they would skip that one and come back later. Or maybe there would be two slips in 1 week, so the community would kind of divide. But the community kept forming and reforming, and you know, always knew it was going to be there. If you were gone for a week, or even if you were gone for the rest of the season, you knew if you came back that it would be there. And it would be different from before, but it would really also be the same. The community was this entity in itself. You'd always see some of the same faces and some new faces and never the same configuration twice. And when we built these elevators, there were various jobs to do, and you would find yourself assigned to a certain job, or maybe you would volunteer for it. And the way it worked was there was a large wooden deck which would cover the entire area of the grain elevator. It would be on a slab, which would be the base of the grain elevator. And this big wooden built deck would be built. And at the outside of the deck would be these forms where you would pour the cement. So the forms were about this wide, so that would be the wall of the elevator. It's on the outside of the deck. And people could move around up on the deck. You know, that's where they would be. And the form would be about 4 feet deep. And people would pour cement into it from on the deck. And they would start with the first pour. It would be about this much. And they would pour, after they poured that, they'd wait about 40 minutes, then they'd pour some more, then they'd pour some more, then they'd pour some more, till the entire 4 feet was full. Then the cement at the bottom would be dry so they could move the whole thing up. There were these jacks all around. There were these jacks on these steel poles. And by engaging all the jacks at the same time, they would jack the entire deck up about 4 inches. So that cement on the bottom would now be exposed. You know, it was drying. And they would just keep doing that. They would just keep jacking it up like that. So over the course of 5 to 7 days, the whole thing would be built in that way. And you'd keep pouring around the clock, and there were 2 12-hour shifts. And we usually worked night shift, my friends and I, my brother Jim and I, we usually did this together. And we liked the night shift because you could watch the sun go down, you could watch the sun go up. There weren't as many people around, there weren't as many supervisors around, so you kind of relax a little bit. And all the really interesting people worked at night also. And there were some really interesting people that did this kind of work. So you had these people, and they would have different jobs. You had people who would move the cement. There would be a crane which would drop some cement into a hopper on the deck. And then people would go and collect the cement in a buggy. They'd go under the hopper, door would come out, the cement would come into a buggy. The buggy's kind of like a wheelbarrow, except it had 2 big wheels on the side. So they get a few hundred pounds of cement in there, and then they take the buggy, and they push it to the edge, and they pour it into the form. And there would be a person with a shovel there helping them out, you know, so they get just the right amount of cement in there. And then there would be people who ran steel. And they would take these bent steel rods, because you had to have steel to hold the whole thing together. And they would go kind of running along the side and putting the steel into the forms. But they couldn't just pop it in there because all these jacks were in the way. So they were kind of moving around the jacks. They'd, you know, have to grab it here, move around the jack, grab it here, and kind of keep running like that. And then there were also finishers, and that's what I did the most. And a finisher is a person who works on the outside of the elevator. You have the deck up here, you have the elevator growing, and then you have a scaffold hanging down from the deck. And I would spend my time on that scaffold, and as the deck got jacked up and the wet cement was exposed, I would use a float and a brush and make it look nice. So I worked on the scaffold, just standing on a couple of planks, a couple of 2x4s for rails, and that was it. And there were also people on the ground, you know, who were helping with all that stuff, and there were supervisors and all kinds of people. And as you can imagine, there was a really interesting cast of characters which would do this kind of thing. They weren't really typical construction workers. A lot of free spirits, wanderers, people who would only work a few weeks out of the year, guys with long braids hanging down from underneath their hard hats, that kind of thing. A lot of women, and this was in the mid-70s, when it wasn't so common for women to be able to do construction work and really be appreciated for what they were able to do. And so that was an important part of it. And the jobs were not all that hard to learn. And if you did a few slips, you really had it down and you could do it. But it was amazing to see how much pride people took in their work and how much they would identify with their own particular job and how they would gravitate toward these particular roles. And as someone pointed out one day when we were philosophizing, which is something we did a lot, everyone seemed to think that their job was the most important. And I thought that was interesting. The steel crews were probably the worst of all because they were really strong and they had this steel and they came running through and you'd better get out of their way. And they thought they were pretty darn important. You know, not only were they sort of the most active people, their steel was holding the whole elevator together. And then you had the people who worked with the cement, and they weren't quite as glamorous, but it was the cement. That's what the thing was made out of. So they thought their job was the most important. Also, it took a lot of skill. balancing one of those buggies. You know, it may have had 300-400 pounds of cement in it. And I could do this even though I was really small, because it's not brute strength that's required. It's finesse. You really learn how to operate this stuff. And I would see little people, women weighing only 100 pounds being able to do this. And some of the locals who would also work on it would see these women doing this, and then they would try it, and they felt just really bad because they could not do it as well. So, and then also you had the finishers. And we thought we were really important too, because we're responsible for the final appearance of the elevator. And if it doesn't look good, it's not going to be good for the company. And also we did some really important stuff beyond what was cosmetic. Sometimes the people who ran the steel would not tie up a rod properly, and it would be sticking out of the wall. And so we would have to call for someone to lower a cutting torch down and cut it off and then patch up the hole. And if you've ever looked closely at the outside of a grain elevator, which I'm sure you all have, you might see little rust streaks, little tiny rust streaks all over. And what those are, that's where somebody didn't cut off the steel properly, and then the rains came and the rust streak went down the side of the elevator. So we did that, and we would also fix holes. Sometimes when the forms would be going up, they would catch a piece of steel that wasn't tied properly, and it would lift the whole thing up, and you would have a hole, you know, maybe this wide, maybe this tall, right through the elevator. So we finishers, we would fix this up, and it took a lot of skill. You have to have just the right amount of cement, just the right consistency. You have to put it in there kind of slowly and be very patient. And if we didn't do that, the whole elevator would be absolutely worthless. So we were really, really important, we thought. So, and the supervisors probably thought they were most important, and probably the people who drew up the plans thought they were pretty important. The people on the ground who got us the cement and got us the steel and everything, they thought they were pretty important, but nobody else thought so. They were called ground pounders, and everybody thought they were kind of an inferior species. And I got sent to the ground a couple of times myself, and I really hated it. The second slip we ever did was in Albert City, Iowa. And at the time, it was the biggest single tank in the world. It was really a cool job, and I liked being on it. And I was running steel. But after about 4 or 5 days, they didn't need as many people to run the steel because it gets easier as you go up. And they sent me down to the ground. And my job was this. When the cement trucks, they back in and they empty their cement into a hopper, and my job was to scrape out the chute when they were done. And I was just mortified. I thought that there was just no dignity in that at all. And also, I was really cold. It was fall, and I wasn't moving around very much, and I was just freezing. And I found out the only way to keep warm was to go to where the waiting cement trucks were and their engines were running, and to actually lie down on the hood of the truck and get some heat that way. So nobody wanted to be on the ground. Also, the slip rats, which is what we call ourselves, we didn't think the locals were very important because they didn't know much about slips. And the locals didn't think the slip rats were very important because they didn't know anything about their town. And they would be gone in a week. So perhaps I'm exaggerating this a little bit to prove a point. I mean, it's true that it was a really tough environment in a lot of ways. And people would be disparaging, and people really would say, you know, get out of my way or you'll get hurt. It was kind of a tough environment. But at times people were really kind as well. And I remember that night when I was so cold that eventually there was a guy who gave me his jacket to wear. And that was such a kind thing. I never learned his name or anything, but I still remember that over 30 years later. I remember how kind that was and how good it felt to be warm at last. So I'm exaggerating a little bit about the tendency to be narrow-minded about the importance of one's job, just a little. But that's to demonstrate that we have this human tendency to see only one part of the whole, and it's almost always the part that we're involved in, and to think that that part is the most important, and we don't really need to look at the other parts as much as we look at our own part. But, you know, in reality, of course, every person who worked on the grain elevator was essential to it. And that included the people who shoveled the cement as much as the people who ran steel, and even the locals, and even the bosses. It was all interrelated, and each part was absolutely essential. And because it's interdependent, the definitions we use for these things have limited usefulness, as I was talking about with a farmer in his fields. What is an elevator when you're done? Is it just the structure? Is it the experience of it? Is it the effort that went into it? We finishers used to sign them. We'd get up toward the top and we'd write our names on the side. So I've got my name on these things all over the Midwest. Does that mean I'm still part of these things? Or is my part in it over? Who decides? The structure of the elevator is a single thing for some purposes, say tax purposes, insurance purposes, but that is only one of 1,000 different ways of looking at it. It's also an experience that happened. It's a memory that I have. It's an image that you have in your mind. That image is different from my memory, and my memory is different from the actual experience. So what is it? What really happened? What really happened? I think nothing definitive really happened. Nothing that we can say that's real. There's only this choice between many, many ways of looking at interdependent reality and cutting it up and providing names for the pieces. What it is just what it is. None of the names we give it can ever hope to approximate what really is. Nothing exists on its own. And that is totally and completely okay. There's a small part of us that really likes to cut things up in this way and really clings to the parts and really clings to the names and likes to circle the wagons and doesn't like to see the interrelationships. But there's this other part, a larger part, you might say, that sees how limited and artificial it is to divide things up in this way and to stick with the divisions after they've outlived their usefulness. This part knows that it can give up the name. This part also knows that it can name things with wild abandon because it knows that it's just naming. It knows that the name is not the thing. As soon as you name a thing, you can't see that thing anymore. Although you can now see the name. That's the new thing. Just don't name that. This is why we can't describe our meditation experiences very well. We try to. We'll say something like, it's like I have this light in my brain. but it's hard to do. It's hard to do. You can't name what's beyond naming. So the thing about Buddhist practice, one thing about Buddhist practice, is that it helps you to see these interrelationships. And it helps you to see what it is in you that tends to deny these interrelationships. And when you see these things, you do still continue to divide up reality. That can't be avoided. But you see more for what it is. You don't cling to these things so much. You don't hang on to these ideas so much. And it's the simplest thing in the world. It's as simple as seeing a grove as a grove one day. But it takes a tremendous effort to get any more than fleeting glimpses of this. Don't be content with fleeting glimpses. Don't waste this precious life. There was this guy from California who did slips. I started thinking about this stuff, and all of this, these memories came back. And I hadn't thought about this guy for a long time. His name was Jose, and he was from California, and he was a finisher too. And I worked with him 2 summers or maybe 3. And he was a spiritual person. He practiced some kind of Hindu meditation that I wasn't really familiar with. I still don't know just what it was. But he was very serious about spirituality. And I had read some books about Buddhism, and we would have long talks about spiritual matters. We'd be out on the finishing scaffold. We'd be watching the sun go down, and from up there you can see for miles and miles. You can see the fields. You can see the town. You can see neighboring towns. It's really quite beautiful. And with this distant view, you know, it's just a great place to kind of feel pretty calm. The higher you get on a slip, the less time you're actually working, and you get large amounts of time. You might work for 15 minutes and then get 40 minutes to just kind of stand there and watch things. So we would do this. And what I remember about him, about this guy, is that he challenged me a little bit about my spiritual practice in the gentlest way possible by kind of asking me if I was ever going to commit to a spiritual life. And I don't think he asked it in words even. I don't think he came out and said, you know, Ted, when are you going to do this thing? I can tell it matters to you, and I can tell you're not doing it. When are you going to do that? He didn't do that. I could just tell that was a concern he had. It was just sort of there. You know how sometimes something is there, you don't say it, but it's so obvious to both people who are conversing. But he could see that I was having a good time building these grain elevators, but he could also see I didn't know where I wanted to be. You know, I was kind of inhabiting this sort of half hippie, half redneck world, kind of trying them both out. And I really didn't know what I wanted, and I really didn't know how I wanted to be. And I had this really gentle side, and I had this side which was not so gentle. And one night, I remember, I told him, you know, I've decided what I'm going to do. I'm going to vacillate. I'm always going to vacillate between the spiritual life. And I was kind of messing with him a little bit. You know, that's kind of the redneck side, I guess. And trying to make light of it in a way. But I can remember being really troubled by my own response. And I was feeling really that I just wasn't anywhere, that I just did not know what I wanted to do, that I was wasting my precious life. And looking back, I know that was okay, because I had to go through a lot more stuff, a lot more twists and turns, and a crisis or two before I really began to get serious about my practice. I wasn't ready at that time. But I'm so grateful that he was there with his really gentle manner to ask this thing. It's like, when are you going to begin? When are you going to begin? You know, I wish I could see him again and I could say, hey, guess what? I began. You know, I took this little step, a little step. I've got a long ways to go yet, but I did take that step. But I can't tell him that. But what I can do is I can ask you the same thing. I can issue this little challenge. Which way are you going to go? Have you begun? If you haven't begun, when are you going to begin? And if that question makes you uncomfortable, the way his question made me uncomfortable, then I think I've done my job this morning. You know, and you don't have to answer this question this morning, and you don't have to resolve this question this morning. But there it is. There's the question. Do not waste this precious life. So perhaps my conversations with this guy leaning on the rail, watching the sun go down, maybe this was the beginning of Sangha for me. Sangha, for people who haven't heard that word before, that's a word that describes the community of people who practice Buddhism together. Maybe this was the beginning of Sangha for me, because a good Sangha not only supports you in your practice, it also challenges you a little bit. And that was the first time I had ever really been challenged. The other people in the Sangha, if you really kind of give yourself to Sangha, can have a profound effect on you. The Sangha is like the grove. It's made up of individuals, but each individual is shaped by his or her relationships with the other individuals. And there's this larger entity that has its own existence. That's maybe why we're a little hesitant sometimes to join a sangha, because we don't want to be shaped, because that's a little scary, because we have to give up something of our own. But I think that's what spiritual growth is about, giving up something of our own. So I keep coming back to sangha in my talks. You may have noticed that. And I do this for a couple of reasons. One is that I'm just so profoundly moved by this sangha, by my place in this sangha, by what this sangha has meant to me. And the other is that I just want to encourage everyone to be a part of the sangha, to really take part in it, to not hang back, to find ways to lean into the sangha, even if that's a little scary, even if that's a little risky. Because sangha, I think, is really essential to the process of living this life vividly, of learning to do that. So sometimes I come here for a sitting and I see individuals and I think of them as individuals, but so much of the time I feel like I'm seeing the grove rather than the tree. I'm seeing this Zen Center entity, and I'm so aware of all the lives that this center has touched, going back years and years, and all the people who have sat here, and all the people who have sat there, thousands of people, and the effect that this place has had on so many people. And this effect is going to continue, I'm positive, for generations. And I'm very moved by this, and I'm grateful for it. And if you're a little tentative about sangha, or if you're brand new, I would just like to invite you in a little further. Because, as I said upstairs earlier today, I cannot think of a better way to make the world a better place than to participate in this, what we are doing. So I would like to again express my appreciation to everyone who keeps this place going. Each person who does a job here is vital. Even the ground pounders. Especially the ground pounders. Everyone, you know, the people who open for a sitting once a week, the people who have the keys, the people who make the website work, the people who shovel the gravel onto the Some people do more and some people do less. There's a lot of work to do here. We all need to find the proper balance because we all have other things to do. We have families. We may have health concerns. We have jobs. We have these things. Some of us can lean in more. Sometimes we lean in at one time and lean out at another time. We all need to find that balance. And no one should feel that he or she is being asked to give more than is appropriate for them. But I would like to give everyone here another little challenge, which is that you not do less either, that you not do less than you're capable of either. There are lots of jobs available here, lots of ways of getting involved, little and big, and they're not always apparent, and sometimes you have to do some looking, ask some questions to find out where it is that you can fit in, what it is that is unique about you, what skills you have that you can bring with you to make this place flourish and be what it is. But you can do it. So, welcome to the Grove. It's a sweet and shady place. So, that's it. Those are some challenges for you. Connect with the Sangha. And begin, and don't waste time. Thank you. Boy, nice turnout this morning. Mm-hmm. So, wow, that was long. But we have a few minutes if anyone would like to make a comment or ask a question or something.
See, I would just like to say thank you so much for building these things.
Really?
And see the view from there.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
Wow. For the tape, if you couldn't hear the question, we have a renegade elevator climber in the audience. Cool. So, yes.
I really love your talk.
Thank you.
But I think you should explain some of the side effects of your talk too.
Some of the side effects.
Because you know, the idea of don't waste your precious life. Should we now panic?
Should you now panic about wasting your precious life? One person in the audience, who's quite experienced, says yes. And I'm repeating these things to give me time to think. Well, a little panic can go a long ways. it really helped to bring me here. But I tell you. If you're going to panic, the best place to do it is right here. So is that a satisfactory answer?
Just
take it easy.
Been having room all the night.
Sure, yeah. All right. So I think that's enough. Thank you so much for listening. Now that I'm scaring people, I think that's enough. So thank you so much, and I hope you can stick around, have some coffee, have some tea, have some snacks, talk to people around you, some really interesting people here to hang out with, and hope to see you again soon.